Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about the week's news. On our first media roundtable of the year, we are discussing the state of the media in the U.S., what communities lose when newspapers shut down, and what it will take to bring back local news. Between January 2005 and December 2020, about a quarter of U.S. local print newspapers shut down. Over 200 counties in the U.S. have no newspaper, according to the Washington Post. Today, we'll also discuss coverage of the anniversary of the January 6th attacks on the Capitol, the rise of the far right, and the normalization of disinformation campaigns and lies by Donald Trump and the Republican Party. Today, we're joined by three guests. Dr. Nikki Usher is an award-winning author and associate professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and senior fellow at the Open Market Institute Center for Journalism and Liberty. Nikki is the author of several books, including News for the Rich, White and Blue, How Place and Power Distort American Journalism, which examines the challenges facing journalism in terms of place, power, and inequality. Hi, Nikki. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're also joined by Robert McChesney, Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and co-founder of the media reform organization Free Press. Robert is the author of People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy, and Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Hi, Robert. Thanks so much for joining us again.
My pleasure.
John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of many books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. Hi, John. It's always great to have you.
It's great to be with you and with Nikki and Bob.
Well, and Happy New Year to all of you. Thank you so much for joining us. I just want to ask you all about coverage of January 6th. Of course, it got nonstop coverage yesterday. What are your thoughts just on, you know, how you're reflecting on what happened and really coverage of the Republican Party and how it has really changed under Donald Trump? John, you cover this. What really stands out for you?
Well, as always, the media is playing catch up, right? It's way behind the story. And so what we've seen over the last year is an evolution where media outlets really struggled to figure out how to describe what happened on January 6th and to describe the play out of it, to make the connections. And it, now, a year on with an anniversary, you are seeing some reasonably good work in that regard. And I'd say that's even on cable TV, but certainly papers like The Guardian, I'd like to think our magazine, The Nation, New York Times and others have done some pretty good, you know, kind of across the landscape coverage of the last year. But the challenge I've got with it, now just it's a quick critique, is that I think that we're still, you know, kind of in this mode of imagining, a lot of our media is in a mode of imagining that we're somehow going to go back to something normal, right? That you know, some Liz Cheney has just got to figure out the one-liner that is going to, you know, renew, you know, neoconservatism as the driving force in the Republican Party, and all will be well. And that just isn't going to be; it's not going to happen. And so, to my view, there's an overcoverage of the Liz Cheneys of the world, and undercoverage of the fundamental reality that the Republican Party has experienced a radical shift. And it's not going back. And we have to report on things from that perspective, not on this sort of romanticized perspective of what might happen, you know, in the dreams of somebody on Wall Street.
Nikki, what would you add?
I think that what we're seeing is a fundamental failure of the American news media to, especially the sort of, let's just talk about institutional news media, not sort of hyper-partisan media, but a complete failure to be able to move beyond traditional news norms. It's really hard to get out of this idea of neutrality. I think that's part of why we see what John is saying about this sort of hope of a return to normalcy, because you know, the American news media is uncomfortable calling the Republican Party what it has become, which is a party that is fueled by racist nationalism. I think that another major failing of the American news media and the coverage of January 6th is the failure to systematically explain how much of what we see happening among the American population is a return to nativism and racism that is deep-seated in American culture. And we need a real deep dive into why that is manifest and what we can do to fight it. So those are the two flaws I see.
What would you add, Bob?
Well, I think John and Nikki have both said they've taken the good stuff. So I'm left to throw some crumbs on the plate. I would only augment what Nikki said, which is that we're in a and John too. We're in a historic moment, a turning point that really requires journalism that is much richer in understanding the stakes that we're dealing with, and holding everyone to account, not just the really obvious, in my opinion, bad guys, the fascists, the liars, the con artists. But those guys only get where they get when they're sort of not held into account by people who could do more than they're doing. And I think there's a tendency in what passes for our news media today at the national level to not necessarily call into account people in power who are opposing the Republicans or the fascists sufficiently to deal with the real crisis we're facing.
John, the thing that kind of struck us is that there's so much focus on January 6th, and that's, of course, very important, and 4 years under Trump. But we had on historian Nancy McLean yesterday. She's a historian and a professor at Duke. And she says, look, we have to talk about what has happened over the last six decades, about how the right has worked to obviously change the rules, but to fundamentally alter the rules of democratic governance. And that just needs so much more attention.
Absolutely, it does. And you know, Nancy's done tremendous work in that regard. A number of other people have as well. And here's really where the challenge is. In elite media, right? In the media read by people who consume, you know, six newspapers a day and five magazines and troll the web and have the time to do that, there's a pretty rich discussion of the assault on democracy. Historians may look back at this moment, and if they're casual historians, they'll say, wow, you know, people saw it coming. They wrote big, long articles about it, and they talked about it a lot. But it is not a part of the fabric of our daily communications for most Americans. I don't think that there is an awareness of the depth to which democracy itself is threatened. And why is that? Well, because, you know, this goes back to education. We have a lot of false constructs as how we teach about America. We teach, and too often, and actually with the, you know, all the debates about, you know, now teaching about racism in the schools and things like that, critical race theory, we teach a notion of America that it was sort of founded in perfection, and that, we had a few flaws along the way, but we fixed them real quick, and then everything else is great. That's just false. It's fundamentally false, but it's very hard for media to wrap its head around that. It's very hard for a newspaper writer or a TV reporter to catch up with the whole of this problem. And so they frankly often avoid it, or they write articles that don't jive with what people know. And the quickest way I'll say that is just that we were founded as a country where about 4 to 5% of people could vote. The story of America is a often violent, often incredibly difficult struggle to get to popular franchise, to get to a point where most Americans can vote. And we really only got there even on the cusp of it in the 1970s, at which point, as Nancy McLean points out, we began a 50-some year deconstruction of what we had achieved. And you know, I could take the rest of the show and explain that more, but that's the problem, because most of our media is trying to enter into that at their best, trying to enter that deeper discussion. And it's very, very hard to catch America up to that reality. And I think, and one final thing I'll point out is that right now the right is fighting on issues like critical race theory to take education about that reality out of our schools and out of our public discourse.
Right. And Nikki, can you elaborate a bit on what you said about race? What are your thoughts about how the elite media are bringing race and racism into these conversations and their coverage? Because a lot of people are now talking about that University of Chicago study that found that the insurrectionists were mostly middle, in some cases upper class, motivated by white population decline in areas where they live. In many cases, it's areas where Biden won. So talk more about the racial coverage, what you're seeing, what you're not seeing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's something that I wanted to just address that John pointed out, and then I'll get to that, which is that we're presuming that half of America even believes in the kind of media that we're talking about today. So to some degree, we can talk about the performance of the institutional news media, but know full well that 72% of Republicans don't have any trust and the kind of, you know, in what we are on right now today. And I think that it's very hard to keep that in mind, but not having that front and center, I think, distorts the way that coverage happens and distorts the way we think about the problem. To get more specifically to your question about race, it's something I think deeply about and write a lot about in my book, News for the Rich, White, and Blue. It is good that the American news media is finally recognizing that it too must have its own racial reckoning. And you cannot get good coverage of race and structural inequality in the United States without empowering decision makers in newsrooms to take on injustice as injustice and not have a moral sort of flippancy or a moral neutrality. So I think that's one issue, is really the lack of diversity in the American news media to appreciate how deep-seated this racist replacement theory is happening. Because if you talk to any journalists of color, they're not surprised. It's not new, right?
Right.
It's just, it's very, very visible, and Trump helped pave the way. So that's my real concern.
Well, and then there's such a focus on this right now to bring in more people of color into newsrooms, which is also obviously a very important thing. The question is, what happens when they get there? Are their hands tied because of systemic issues in the newsroom because of what they've just done for decades? Or are they able to be independent to really push the envelope?
I mean, I think I would look to the experiences of Wes Lowery as indicative of what happens when journalists, especially journalists of color, try to directly make a moral claim about something very factual, like police shouldn't kill Black people, right? They kill more Black people than they do white people. Factual statement. But for a journalist of color, it's immediately suspect that they can't be objective about covering race. But what the American news media needs to realize is that this premise of objectivity, not only is it flawed for reasons, you know, we can all talk about, but it comes from a default whiteness, right? It is not a question of objectivity for some of these journalists to be out on the streets reporting, knowing that they are vulnerable to the very same issues of police violence and police brutality. And so what ends up happening is that there is until these journalists are empowered to be trusted at their word, that it's not a violation of journalistic principles to acknowledge the racist underpinnings of American society, I don't think we're going to see the kinds of changes that we really need to see. And I think news organizations are scared, and they're scared because they want to reclaim these, you know, 72% of Republicans who no longer trust the news media. They're scared to move beyond, and that's a real, real barrier.
Bob, anything to add on this? What are you hearing from news executives? Are you in touch with a lot of people who are making decisions? And if so, what are you hearing from them about these issues?
Well, actually, I'm not on speed dial with a lot of news media executives at this point in my career. And if I can go back to your takeoff point on Nancy McLean's work, and this really gets to what I think John and Nikki were talking about too. You know, the genius of her research has been that it shows how the modern conservative movement that took over the Republican Party during the 1970s and certainly by the 1980s was predicated on limiting democracy. They understood they only represented a minority of the population. So early on, they understood it was in their interest to limit the ease of people voting, limit the number of people who voted. And they understood the policies they were pushing, privatizing social services, getting rid of progressive taxation, were policies that were very popular with the great majority of Americans. So they had to find issues to get votes on because they couldn't run on their actual record. And this is where the whole rise of the Republican Southern strategy really playing on white grievance and white racism as an undercurrent of their voter support came in. And I think what happened is by 2016, Donald Trump showed the game was deeply flawed. That he basically understood the voters were just full of rage and anger and hostility and racism and chauvinism. And they really didn't care about all that free market balance, the budget BS that Newt Gingrich was telling us they were about. And so he fed them the red meat. He said, okay, I'm going to give you what you want. You want to hate Arabs? You want to hate Mexicans? Here you go, guys. And they loved him. And he didn't back down when he was called on it. And that all the candidates who ran on the traditional Republican stuff had found there were no voters for them. Jeb Bush couldn't even pay someone to vote for him. And that, I think what we see is that the two are connected. The anti-democracy rooted in the modern Republican experience leads directly to the base that makes Donald Trump possible.
I'm so glad you brought this up. John, in The Nation in August, there was an amazing piece called The Anti-Asian Roots of Today's Anti-Immigrant Politics by Marie Uhara. And she writes, this toolkit of fear-mongering propaganda, threats of violent removal, and exclusionary policy prescriptions has endured. It was one that Trump cannily wielded for his inaugural run in 2015. The real estate mogul had been fairly pro-immigrant until 2014, when his political advisors identified what would become a central campaign message, listening to what one described as thousands of hours of talk radio and finding that the Republican base was rabid about, quote, illegal immigration.
It's exactly right. And, you know, look, there's two parts of this that are really important. And so let's divide it up. First off, you know, when I wrote my book on Trump's inner circle, Horseman of the Trumpocalypse, I wrote a chapter on Steve Bannon, and it was all about this. You know, this is Bannon is, whether you like him or not, really smart. And he deals in a lot of data. He deals in a lot of research. And it was really Bannon and some of his allies who drove a great deal of this. And what they determined was that, yes, I mean, this ground has been seeded. It was seeded years ago. And all you had to do was listen to, you know, the panoply of right-wing talk radio shows, to listen to Fox on any given day. And it was there. It's actually worse now on Fox than it was in the past. But it's always been there in a lot of our media. And so what Bannon basically and some of his allies told Trump was, look, for years, the Republican Party, as Bob suggests, and as Nikki also suggests, for years, the Republican Party was a lie. Right. It was a bunch of rich people who said, look, to a great mass of folks, vote for us and we'll give you what you want. We'll ban abortion. We'll do all this other stuff. And then they didn't really do as much of it as they promised to do. Instead, they got power and then they lowered their own taxes. Right. It was a very simple game. What Trump was taught to do was to say, tell the base that the elites of the party have been lying to you, and then that promise them that you will do what they want you to do. And that would be enough to break up the Republican Party. It was exactly true. It succeeded completely. The Republican Party, as it was obliterated. And so that's the core of that concept. And it was rooted in understanding what was going on in media and understanding the change in media, particularly the power of social media. One last thing I'll say is that really the history of this is so deep, though. I mean, you can't look at American history and not recognize that this has always been here. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not, I mean, Trump is not some outlier. He is a continuation. And the biggest problem I see, and I don't want to open up a whole new can of things here, but I will say, I've been very passionate in the view The big problem has been the Republican, not the Republican Party, but the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party hasn't figured out how to combat this and how to deal with this. And because our media tends to cover just the two parties, it tends to cover elites on each side, it doesn't do a good job of really digging into it deeper. And so you, at the end of the day, you still have, you know, Democratic officials who are cautious in talking about this. And it's a deeply frustrating reality because our media reflects the popular discourse at the elite level, and the elite level isn't good at talking about this. And so as a result, we don't dig into the point where we should be.
Well, so tell us more about that. How should they dig into this point? What would you like to see?
Well, I mean, I think you started to see people talk about this already, and that is that you know, you should identify the Republican Party as it currently exists as a white nationalist party, right? As a party that is indeed dealing in racism, xenophobia, et cetera. And you know, say, well, oh, that's a pretty extreme statement. No, it's writ large across every statement and article and who they protect, Marjorie Taylor Greene, people like that on a daily basis, and who they kick out, you know, Liz Cheney, a neoconservative extreme right winger who is just not sufficiently over the deep end, right? So that's the evidence is clear. And also, all I'm asking is not something radical. What I'm suggesting is we ought to do what they do in France or in Germany or in the United Kingdom or in any place else in the world. If you have a white nationalist party, if you have a party that is dealing in racism and xenophobia, you identify it as such. You write about it as such. You won't pick up any French newspaper that writes about, you know, the different parties on the right in France and the different political figures who are rising going into this year's presidential election that doesn't identify them as, you know, white nationalists or nationalists, or, you know, they're pretty blunt about it. But our media is incredibly polite. It continues to say, you know, well, there's two parties and there's differences of opinions. You know, it's not a difference of opinion, right? These are fundamentally different values.
Before we go to break, Nikki, what would you add to that?
I think that John's really hit it on the nose, but what we're failing to discuss is the tendency of the news media to also cover and flock to extremes. And so some research has suggested that the more extreme a political candidate or a lawmaker is, the more coverage they attract. And you can see that Marjorie Taylor Greene's career, right, is absolutely about that. I've been tracking that here in Illinois with the rise of an anti-masker candidate who looks like he could win the gubernatorial Republican nominee. And these aren't people who are made by the right wing. They're already known in the right wing. They're made and institutionalized by the institutional mainline news media.
And you make a great point, because the fact is we all look. You see something that Marjorie Taylor Greene says, it's on Twitter, and it just gets millions and millions of views. We touched on this yesterday. It's like driving by, you know, the accident. You don't want to look, and you look. And one thing that Nancy McLean said is we've got to stop doing that and really focus on the important work at hand. But the fact is, Nikki, it's hard not to look.
I completely, and there's an economic incentive to focus on these extremes, as we'll talk about shortly. So,
well, we're going to take a quick break. That is Dr. Nikki Usher, Associate Professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Senior Fellow at the Open Markets Institute Center for Journalism and Liberty. Nikki Usher is the author of several books, including News for the Rich, White, and Blue, How Place and Power Distort American Journalism. Robert McChesney is Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, co-founder of Free Press, and author of People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy. John Nichols is National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation and author of The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. And you can find more about our guests' work and their books at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you'd like to join today's conversation about the current state of the media, we'd love to hear from you. What is local news like in your area? Where do you go to find out what is happening in your backyard, city hall, even at the state level? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Dr. Nikki Usher, author of News for the Rich, White, and Blue, How Place and Power Distort American Journalism. Robert McChesney is author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. John Nichols is author of The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Let's spend some time talking about all of these really devastating newspaper closures. Over 200 counties in the United States have no newspaper whatsoever, according to the Washington Post. And Elaine Godfrey, a journalist who has studied these issues in Burlington, Iowa, recently wrote in The Atlantic that people tend to participate less often in municipal elections, and those elections are less competitive, corruption goes unchecked, and costs sometimes go up for town governments. Disinformation becomes the norm. Bob, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, what really happens to communities when they lose access to their local paper?
Well, I think the research shows pretty clearly that all sorts of bad things happen and nothing good happens as a result of that. And it really, it can be approached both as a political issue of the ability of people to actually participate in local governance, monitor people in power. And it also can be viewed in a broader cultural issue, but they're related. The cultural issue is that, you know, people feel like they're on a raft in the middle of the ocean without any connection to other people, rather than being united in some sort of solidarity with the people you share the community with. And so, but they go together. And ultimately, why it's important is that people say, well, local media, hey, I've got my cable channel and I've got a subscription to Wall Street Journal, I'm set. Local media has always been the foundation of the best aspect of the American democratic tradition. And it sort of got overlooked with the gloss of the national media in the past generation or two. But now that we've lost local media, we see we're losing most of national media as well. The two are linked together. And it's a disastrous situation. And I jump ahead to the conclusion, because we don't have a lot of time, it gives rise to the sort of movements on the right, fascist movements, thrive in journalism-free environments like the one we're in now.
Hmm. John, what would you add?
Yeah, I think Bob set it up well, and we should acknowledge that Bob and I write a lot of books together and done a lot of stuff with together over the years, and so we do tend to play off each other. So I would just add that, you know, I don't think you can have a discussion like the one that we had in the first half of this program without looking at media. And because the three of us are on, we've obviously done a bit of that in the first half. But this is a really vital thing to understand. If you want to know why Trump has been so successful and why the Republican Party has flipped so quickly, of course you look at the history. Of course you look at the underpinnings and all the issues of race and in our society and xenophobia, et cetera. But you also have to understand that this is happening at a unique moment in our history. Our local media is collapsing. We have roughly half as many working journalists as we had 20 years ago. If you look at the Washington Post data that came out recently on it, you talk about 200 counties that don't have a newspaper. That's true. But then you get into the thousands that have one, right? You know, that have essentially, you know, lost most of what they have. It's one thing hanging on. And so you end up in the situation now where our discussion has kind of been dumbed upward, right? And not dumbed downward, but dumbed upward. And so we get our kind of take on the news of the day from cable TV, from talk radio, from social media, from all of these institutions that fill the void that used to be filled by local media and by competing local media, different voices, different ideas. And the big issue here is that propaganda has stepped in to the game. Mm. You know, it's when we talk about Fox or MSNBC or CNN or even conservative talk radio, that's one level of it. Many of those institutions still trying to make money. They're still out there they're saying what they think is popular with their base and trying to chase a story. But you've now got, social media and the internet filled with institutions that have been developed to literally lie, to promote a propaganda on a regular basis. And it's very, very successful. It's at this point, because people still want information, they just don't know where to get it, and they don't have reliable local sources, they are increasingly open to, what they pick off Twitter, what they pick off off Facebook, et cetera. And the end result is that we end up in a situation where there is a news void, and that void is being filled by people who are trying to drive deeper wedges into this country to try and make it more volatile than it already is. And it's not going to change until we address that void.
Well, Nikki, that's what's so, I don't know if the word interesting is right, but interesting about this moment, because we're bombarded with so many new podcasts, so many new online outlets. I mean, if you have that Apple News app, which I check out in the morning, I mean, I can read a story at the Miami Herald, the Atlantic. I mean, you name it, it's on there. Yet there's such a void at the local level. So how do you see this? What are your thoughts about, what is really happening by losing so many local papers and really relying on these national elite institutions?
Can I be like the extremely grumpy person in the room?
Please.
Because I think, and this is something I really try to do in the book, but I do want to offer a quick stat that is really helpful for contextualizing this. This is in a Shorenstein report by my colleague, Matt Hyman, that local news, based on his research, gets 0.5% of internet views. And 80% of visits to news sites go to national news sites.
Wow.
Which I think is a stunning assessment of demand, right? That's what people are choosing to do with their time. Mm. But for the grumpy person part, I think that, so first of all, 200 newspapers out of 3,143 counties in the United States amounts to about 6%. I don't doubt that the needs for local news and information are absolutely critical to the day-to-day decision making that people make, right? So I want to be clear here, but I also want us to have a very serious conversation about the ahistorical nature of claiming that across the board, local newspapers in America have been net good. Because if we just look at contemporary history in my own biggest city, the Chicago Tribune has reinforced racist stereotypes around Black criminality today, right? But even looking a little bit back, right, there are newspapers in the North and the South that have deeply, deeply segregationist pasts. And in the town I live in now, which has one of these threatened small newspapers, and Bob is familiar with it as he used to be a part of the Illinois community, I don't see a newspaper worth seeing. I see a newspaper that's filled with people who are reinforcing white supremacy and the white power structure of the town. The idea that these newspapers across the board are providing some check on corruption or, high quality local news and information, or even that they once did, is a real fallacy of how we think about America. And I think until we really come to bear with the fact that our local news media is just as problematic as the rest of American history, I don't think we can come up with clear-eyed solutions moving forward. Hmm. So I'm writing a lot about this. I understand that I'm the grumpy person in the room, but I don't think we need to prop up institutions that are very, very, very problematic. I do think that we have to prop up ways for citizens to have access to the news and information they need to live their daily lives.
No, it is such a great point. What would you say are policy prescriptions around this? Because clearly we need local papers, but not the kind that you describe.
I don't know if we need local papers, right? And the fact that this has been centered on a newspaper crisis and that we don't have a good way of distinguishing local from Miami Herald to local Champaign-Urbana really kind of, I think, distorts the precision around the conversation. But newspapers really don't have to be the answer. And in fact, in a lot of rural communities, when I talk to public health officials about how they're trying to get information about vaccines out, they talk about Facebook and radio. And local television still remains the most trusted form of news. It doesn't have a lot of political content, but that is something that people across the board, regardless of party, still trust. And so I think we need to be really creative. And I developed this concept of news resilience, thinking about what communities have as existing strong institutions that might be tweaked to rethink how we can get the information that they have to the people in their communities. So let's not get hung up on newspapers.
John, what are your thoughts on Nikki's analysis of local papers?
I agree with everything she says. No problem there. And in fact, Bob and I have written extensively about, you know, just how bad newspapers have been throughout history. Our argument has always been that the big challenge in contemporary discussions about media is that we lose sight of the kind of core realities of it, right? And the core reality, of course, is that local newspapers have always been flawed, but they've also often been good. And this is the fascinating thing. I you know, grew up near Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which had a strong socialist daily newspaper throughout much of its much of the 20th century, and across this country historically. We have had multiracial, multi-ethnic daily and weekly newspapers in this country that really were critical to challenging the existing order. And so what we should recognize, though, is that it isn't about the newspapers. It's about the newsroom. It's about a group of people who go out and do journalism, whether they do it online, whether they do it in television, whether they do it in print, whatever way they do it, and broadly expanding the definition of how you get in. The problem that we've got right now is that when you deconstruct local journalism, when it isn't there, right, it becomes, you know, a propagandist dream experience, right? This is the perfect scenario for a propaganda experiment, because if you don't have local sources of news that are consistent and that people know, then you are going to have public health folks, you know, trying desperately to use Facebook or radio or, you know, it's anything they can find to try and promote vaccinations. And they are going to, as we have seen, fail miserably, right? Because the fact of the matter is that we have a huge portion of this country that has chosen not to vaccinate, and it's now a big crisis. And so clearly there is a gap, and it has been, you know, we are living in a propagandist field day right now. So we've got to come up with solutions that, as Nikki suggests, empower people to communicate. And again, I would disagree with any suggestion that it shouldn't be at the local level, because that's where people do know each other. That's where people interact with each other. And frankly, that's where people put an awful lot of their energy. And so we want to create something at the local level that is muscular enough and that is competing, that you don't have just one newsroom, but you have multiple newsrooms and lots of people going out and gathering information and communicating about it with some sense of desire to, you know, tell the truth and maybe even speak a little truth to power. And that's what we've lost. We do not have that in America right now. And it's a desperate gap.
Bob, why don't you jump in here? What would you add?
Well, I mean, Nikki raised a good point that people demand apparently more national news than local news, but this is also a case of supply creating demand, to go to Say's Law. I would go to national news too, because there's nothing local in my community worth reading or looking at. No offense to John, who's connected to one of the two papers here. There's a little bit, but not much, certainly less than there used to be. And also, I agree with John. We're not romanticizing the past, and anyone who's read any of our work knows that. But we are romanticizing, I guess, the notion of a democracy having an informed electorate. I don't think there are enough scraps around there. We just have to pick them up and put them so people can see them, that we have a sufficient journalism. I think we actually need to have resources that will create newsrooms, competitive, independent newsrooms in communities that are covering the community. And it's not simply to provide information. I think the vision that, that John and I have of journalism is probably one that was dominant until the early to mid 20th century, which was the Jeffersonian vision, which was simply the news should be a political institution. It's as important as any branch of government. It's what makes it possible for people without property to participate in governance. And so we need a system that actually does that. We've never had that. We've been better sometimes. We've never been good with African Americans and poor people in general. That's always been a weak spot. But we are now in a dire situation where we do have very little for of anything except the handful of media we're familiar with at the national level. So the goal is basically to create for the first time a democratic media system that draws people into public life, and it provides sort of a political access to be players, to be participants in solidarity with others, rather than just being an isolated consumer, studying whatever facts are given you and doing with it as you please. Hmm.
Robert McChesney is Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Dr. Nikki Usher is Associate Professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. John Nichols is National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. We have a couple of people who've been waiting patiently, so let's take a few calls and emails, and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's go to Calvin in San Francisco. Hi, Calvin. Thanks for holding.
Thank you very much. I have a cold. There's two things I wanted to point out. I'll just make it very quick because I don't have the same ability to go on as long, which is fine. Number one, we've long passed the time of two political parties. This, voicing this and others have been voicing it for a long time. There is no modern democratic-leaning nation in the world that relies on two parties, which is why one small splinter group can hijack a party. I'm not saying we need 50 parties, but there's certainly a lot of space for five. So you have coalitions and consensus that move forward on whatever plans you want, and one small segment would be very hard-pressed to hijack the other party. Number two, this country has moved towards what every other nation in the world, in the history of the world, for over 3,000-4,000 years, towards monopolies. Monopolies don't work, and we're seeing the result of that. They never work. It doesn't matter what institution you place them in. It breaks down an exchange and a proper exchange of ideas and a better overall life for an opportunity for those below. And if you don't mind my throwing in real quickly, the Democrats, I'm assuming they must be bought and sold out, because it's very easy to push. You want to make this nation great again? Fine. We'll return to the 1950s. You like the 1950s? Let's look at the tax rate in the 1950s, because the tax rate at that time was much higher and everyone was more prosperous. So you want to know where your money goes? That's where it goes. So fine. We'll return to those tax rates that were implemented at that time that created...
Well, Calvin, thank you so much for calling. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's go through a few more callers. Eileen in Mountain View. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call and for assembling your illustrious panel. I just wanted to say I'm really frightened because I think the Democrats are playing chess in the park and the pubs are playing ultimate cage fighting without the cage. You know, rules are for losers. But my question is that media used to be the fourth estate, but now it's owned by people with four estates. And how much coverage is restricted by the fact that you've got to dance with the one who brung you, and the one who brung you needs profit? Mm.
Yeah, that's a good one. Thank you. We've talked a lot about that in the past. One more caller, and then a few emails, then we'll get responses. Ernie in San Francisco. Hi, Ernie.
Good morning. It would be a change if the media... covered politicians like a previous caller mentioned. There's only two parties, but it seems a lot more and more like it's a single party, and they're chasing the same. The Democrats are chasing the same dollar the Republicans are, and we even have a delegate in Congress that routinely. Has inside information and gets their investments ahead of everybody else and so forth. And another thing too is maybe cover, we understand how broken the system is, but it's working for somebody, maybe covered at that angle. How is it working for Wall Street, or how is it working for multi-billion dollar, you know, firms and so forth, and their payouts to Congress when they get their multi-billion dollar project through, and how many, you know, thousands of dollars they're distributing through Congress to get their billions of dollars projects approved.
Well, thank you, Ernie. That came up during the show we did about topics to cover this year, and we're definitely going to do more shows about that. Let's hear from one more caller, Lawrence in Berkeley. Hi, Lawrence.
Yeah, hi. There's one important subject that you've been leaving out, which is that all of these supposedly idealized local papers have been bought up by monopolies. So they may publish locally, but they're owned nationally or internationally. And usually what these giant companies do when they buy up a paper is they lay people off, or they kill the newspaper altogether and they just sell it. So you can't really talk about newspapers without talking about monopoly capitalism.
Yes, thank you for that. We will definitely talk about that. I want to read a few emails about local news, and then we'll get responses from our guests. Leslie writes, I've really missed our former local free papers, the SF Independent and the SF Progress. That's where we could follow what was happening at City Hall. We also learned the background of the school board members, judges, candidates for supervisors. It's a great loss to our democracy. Now it seems whomever has the most money to control the press and shout the loudest is the only message people hear. It makes radio programs like this become even more important. Thank you for that, Leslie. We've got another email from a listener who says local papers are way out of touch with changes. The San Francisco Chronicle is highlighting white-run classical Indian dance companies when we're in the Bay Area, and there are plenty of excellent South Asian Indian dance companies, and their reviews are still written by the same white woman who wrote dance reviews two decades ago. We have, and thank you for that comment. Another one, the impact of local papers on communities started to lessen as soon as newspapers lost subscribers to other media sources, whether cable TV or the internet. Towns and cities without a daily source of truly local news have suffered as a result, because everything is blown up to the statewide or the national level. So let's just get responses to all of you. And maybe if you can add some solutions to all of this, a lot of questions about local papers brought up by corporations, corporate ownership. Nikki, why don't you start?
Yeah, so I think this question, it's very interesting to me that just sort of ordinary listeners, even though NPR listeners are not, KLW listeners are not so ordinary, but that antitrust and monopoly is coming up as something that people are readily identifying as problematic and speaking about it within that framework. I think that competition policy needs to be the way forward for thinking about restructuring not just the news media, but also the power of platforms like Facebook and Google, which we have not talked enough about today. But until you have a competitive marketplace for news, information, and the internet, right, and tech, you don't have the ability to really let the marketplace work. The market is now broken. It's terrifying to me that Gannett owns 1/6 of daily newspapers and continues to eat more of them, right? And so when we talk about solutions to save the news media, we have to be really careful that we're not enriching and empowering these beleaguered bloodletters of many American news that own many American newspapers. So I actually see an antitrust solution that begins first, actually, with dismantling the power of big tech and returning to an advertising-based model that can actually work once the strongholds of Facebook and Google over our information are no longer quite so strong. So great questions from the listeners, and I'm really glad to hear this being part of public conversation.
John, what would you add? We have about a minute.
Well, we're not going to get too close to solutions there, are we? First off, there's not going to be an advertising model. It's not going to work. And so I agree with everything Nikki said, except for that component. The one thing that has been proven is that no news outlet's going to make it on its own. And so as a result, we have to have an intervention that gets resources to people that want to create media. And with that, I will hand it over to Bob.
John and I have written an article on this, and Nikki might be familiar with it, on how we basically have to treat journalism as a public good, that the market no longer provides it in sufficient quantity or quality. And we have to use public funds to create a very competitive nonprofit local media all across the country, where the funds are provided by the government. The government has no control over who gets them. They're by elections in those counties get to pick which media receive them, and they have to be nonprofit media. So I think we can solve all the concerns we have, but it's going to take enlightened public policy. And the good news is that's what other democratic countries are doing, similar programs around the world, the most democratic nations. And that's really at our best what we did in the 19th century in the United States.
Hmm. If I could add one final thing, too, sure. Is that you know, we're kind of doing, we're always in that same situation where we are, always are, Rose, with your brilliant show and the great way you do it, that we're rushing to give solutions at the very end. Bob and I had a piece in Columbia Journalism Review recently that dealt with a lot of these issues and laid out some of the possible solutions. And to the extent that I would urge people to look at something, I would encourage people to check that out. And I'd also emphasize that, you know, around the world, when you look for solutions to the rise of fascism, to the rise of nationalism, to the rise of, you know, extremism, you know, again and again, the answer is to provide competing and diverse local media that people can actually trust and that people create themselves, not things that come from big media conglomerates and, frankly, not things that come from propagandists.
Well, we will definitely have you all back and focus on solutions, and we will do that first so we have more time for that. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation, author of many books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Robert McChesney is professor emeritus at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, author of People Get Ready, The Fight Against a Jobless Economy and a Citizenless Democracy, and many other books. Dr. Nikki Usher is associate professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, also the author of several books, including News for the Rich, White and Blue, How Place and Power Distort American Journalism. Nikki, I love that, the headline of your book. And we would love to have you back. Thank you all so much for your great work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very
much. Great to be on with you.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And you can find out more about our guests' books and their work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.